Welcome to Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Moran, Editorial Director of Fixed Income News Australia. Join me as I talk about the latest news, views and education in fixed income investment. I'll be joined by industry experts from Australia and across the globe. Welcome. Today, I'm delighted to have Anthony Kirkham, who is Portfolio Manager at Western Asset Management, part of the Franklin Templeton Group. We're going to be talking about diversity and liquidity. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, Liz. Great to be here.
It's so good to have you, I can't tell you. Anthony, how would you define diversification?
Well, I guess diversity in portfolio management is the practice of investing in a way that reduces exposure to any one particular asset or risk. I guess the simplest example is shown by the good old proverb of don't put all your eggs in one basket.
So that's pretty important, and I'm sure most of our listeners will have heard of people that have lost their entire fortunes on single projects. But what sort of lessons have you learned from diversification over your 30 plus years in markets? And can you think of any market milestones and what they might have taught you?
Yeah, well, my professional experience in markets, which is what, 30 plus years, which is sort of scary, but has always, I guess, centered around diversification. Similarly, at Western Asset, our 50 plus year investment philosophy has also focused on a long-term fundamental value approach alongside multiple diversified strategies. So the key here is that by having diversified strategies, it protects you if your base case is actually wrong. And sadly, let's face it, we aren't always going to be right. So thinking about building a position to provide some offsets ultimately will smooth the overall outcome. You don't want to offset everything, otherwise you're just hedging, but it's important to get that diversity into the portfolio. And that's what we do when we're building our portfolios is, you know, obviously building liquidity into it. Because in different crises, some sectors or securities may be more central to the issue at hand. So by having diversity across industry sectors and types of securities like government and corporate, as an example, will increase your liquidity options. And this is especially a case, I think, in Australia where liquidity is great, but clearly not as liquid as the US market. It just isn't as deep and therefore has less participants. So therefore, the need to ensure that you have that exit or able to exit a position or at least generate liquidity in the portfolio is always front of mind. I guess in terms of that market milestone, which you asked about, or events, it's pretty hard not to forget the pain the crash in the markets had during the GFC. I think it was our last real market-generated crash of size, and it was memorable, I guess, for me, because it was a time my friend's parents were at that age of retirement, experienced life-changing events. So hearing their stories of the asset pools depleted at the time of their life because they weren't properly diversified, as they were generally sort of equity or sometimes property heavy, was a real blow and incredibly painful for them. So the phenomenon is obviously known as sequencing risk. Although we've had learned about it in textbooks, seeing it in action was certainly a life lesson. And clearly one that I never want to experience, hence my own personal portfolio is diversified by asset, country or sector, really just to try and get that diversity. But it's really that key lesson, I guess, was an important one for me to learn.
That's really great. And I remember exactly that time.
Yeah.
Markets in effect blew up.
Yeah.
And things that we thought were liquid really weren't. And it changes. It's evolving, isn't it? It's not static where you think Telstra bonds are going to be liquid and they end up not being liquid.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I think each time it is slightly different. So which is the reason why you need to have that diversity as a set across the different sectors, because you just don't know what the central issue that's caused that crisis is going to do to any particular type of investment. So, you know, having that uncertainty means that you need to be somewhat diversified throughout.
We've actually just recently been through another sort of painful 18 months for bond investors where interest rates rose. And what has that taught you, or what has it taught investors about diversification, do you think?
Yeah, look, I mean, as I said before, I guess, you know, each time is slightly different. So, you know, the importance of having that diversity through time is critical. I think, you know, obviously this rise in interest rates has been, you know, huge, right? It's been caused by, obviously, you know, central banks pushing yields down to generate growth in economies. So it was incredibly artificial in terms of where bond yields got to. And obviously, in some cases, you know, negative territory, which, as I said before, doesn't make any sense to my brain at all. But that's where we got to. And so, therefore, it's very different this time. And so clearly, you know, it has been a shock to anyone investing in bonds because they had no yield to lean on. And obviously, we saw, you know, a sharp move in prices. So it has been difficult. I guess what I'm very pleased about, and I think being part of Franklin Templeton has probably meant that I've seen a little more of this than I did previously. But it's really been interesting watching how the retail and wholesale market has actually behaved since. I think it was quite easy to say, oh, bonds, you know, are bad. They didn't help me at all during that time. But, you know, once again, key is to understand how we got there and why. And it's been really pleasing to see, you know, within that retail wholesale market is that asset allocators have actually moved back into bonds. They've actually recognized the true value is back there. They can now, you know, do their job, I guess. And therefore, you know, critically, you know, people have actually reallocated back into bonds and taken advantage of the yield. And really, once again, that huge diversification benefit from a risk standpoint that you get by holding an asset that is negatively correlated to the equity or property holdings, and therefore, once again, getting exposure. So it's, you know, really pleasing to see that, you know, people recognize that value.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, at the moment, because the yield on bonds is far greater than the dividend yield on shares, and you've got that volatility and that unknown with shares just right now. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. And that's because, as I said before, like, you know, being able to return to fair value, and that's where they should be. But unfortunately, we saw the opposite occur during times where, you know, central banks had their reasons, but it clearly went too far. And I'm pleased to see things return to some normality, I guess.
So just focusing on that fixed income asset class and its subsectors, what to your mind constitutes a diverse fixed income portfolio?
Yeah, look, I mean, a type of fund that I manage, which is obviously an Australian fixed income fund, you know, we do invest across all subsectors within the asset class for the reason of diversity. I think we're fortunate enough to have some good diversified options in Australia now. We like to take advantage of those options. One advantage of our market, I think, becoming investable post-GFC and the government obviously issuing a large amount of bonds. And, of course, we've gone through the pandemic. They've issued another large set of bonds. But it has meant that other investors globally have been able to see our market as an investment option. And so we've had, you know, Japanese insurers using our market now for the past 15 years or so. We've had European sovereigns, you know, get more interested in federal and semi-government paper for their own asset books. And certainly more recently, over the, say, over the past 5 to 10 years, you know, private banks in Asia have definitely been more involved in our corporate market. The benefit of these investors in being in part of our market is that they have different objectives. And so therefore, you know, traditional asset management like ourselves, there's other groups that have got different valuations around, you know, and objectives around what they're looking at the market for. And so therefore, it means that, you know, the market does move a bit and therefore does provide, I think, underweight and overweight opportunities for us that we can move in and out of to take advantage of those pricing differences that we see.
And do you have any subsectors at the moment that you favour or are overweight compared to others?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, in terms of the portfolio, because it is meant to be providing that defensive allocation, we do actually have minimum mandated allocation. So it obviously is, it's important to be able to provide that defense against the decline in risky assets. So, you know, we do have an allocation, a solid allocation to government bonds, and that includes both Australian and state government bonds, just to ensure that it has that defense. But in terms of, you know, I guess how we're currently positioned in terms of our diversification, it's incredibly diversified. You know, I would say and describe it as a barbell approach at the moment to sector positioning, partly because, you know, we want to have that diversity across the different sectors, but different sectors have different values across the yield curve. So somewhat confusing maybe, but if you look at it in terms of like our exposure to, say, federal government bonds, we mainly are invested in that 10-year, 20-year, and 30-year part of the curve. And the reason for that is that these government bonds will provide that true ballast for the fund. So, you know, hard duration, we would call it, and therefore provides that, I guess, that offset, you know, if the economy was to fall into a deeper type recession. It's not our base case. Our base case is sort of soft landing. But, you know, by having that sort of holding of government in the back end of the yield curve, it will definitely provide us that offset. So that's really key. And that's one part of the barbell. The other side of it is the fact that we do think credit at the moment, particularly short dated credit, does provide a really great risk return for an investor. So, you know, we do have a large allocation to credit, but as I said, it's very much short dated. And in fact, when you break up the portfolio, you would say 50% of the holdings of credit are less than 3 years. So that's pretty sure. 75-80% are less than 5 years. So because we're investing in investment grade names, we're very comfortable with, you know, where they're going from a fundamental standpoint, but they can also provide some really nice yield income for investors. And so, as I said, it's barbell, where we've got that, you know, government defense at the back end, but we've got a nice income for investors at the short end in companies that we feel very comfortable with.
I think that's very insightful and quite a good strategy at this point of the cycle, very long dated government bonds and the short dated corporate. Still thinking about the portfolio, how does yield and diversification combine, you know, to work for you?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting one because, you know, clearly different parts, as I said before, like corporate, clearly the fundamentals are still sound because we've got this soft landing scenario. Also, I would say that, you know, companies generally been pretty defensive post the pandemic. They've kept their, I would say, their balance sheet, you know, very solid. They're certainly not leveraging up. And so, you know, it's clearly an advantage to invest in credit, and has been certainly over the last couple of years. But at the same time, you don't want to get carried away, right, with the idea, okay, well, I just want yield. Yield looks really great right now. It's really key to keep in mind that necessity of having diversification because, as I said, you know, part of that view is on the belief that we're going to have this, you know, soft landing, that, you know, central banks will know exactly when to, you know, ease off monetary policy and provide a nice backdrop for the economy. But if they don't, they get that wrong, then clearly it could be something less so. So it's finding that balance, I think, is once again the key, where you're getting yield, but you need to clearly have diversification within it.
So just moving on to liquidity now, there's quite a famous saying that investors don't think about liquidity until they need it, which I imagine is when everyone else needs it as well. So how do you approach liquidity when building and maintaining a portfolio? You know, just from my perspective, probably the government bonds are more liquid part of the portfolio, but perhaps if you could expand on that, Anthony?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, it certainly needs to be a consideration, and it is very important for us, particularly because we're running, obviously, a fund that, you know, is accessible. It's meant to be liquid. People want to be able to get in and out of it. So we absolutely need to consider liquidity as a critical component of it. And so therefore, you know, we obviously need to allocate and, you know, rebalance that portfolio to ensure that we have that liquidity at all times. As I said, look, clearly state and federal bonds are definitely the most liquid. They certainly, you know, typically trade within fractions of a basis point. So, you know, and even during times of, you know, risk off, they are definitely somewhere you can lean on for liquidity. But importantly, you know, you need to be getting it across the portfolio. It's not much good if people are invested in a portfolio where they expect it to be diversified, and all we do is just lean on our government exposure as a way of providing liquidity to investors, and then leaving yourself with a portfolio that, you know, is less diversified. It's not really fair for investors who are still in the fund. So it's really important to be finding it across the board. And, you know, by having that diversity across different sectors, as I say, you know, we've got a pretty large supranational or sovereign agency sector as well in our market. Typically, that's AAA. The good part about that is that there's also shown through different crises that it's very liquid. And that's key as well, because the good thing about SSAs is that they are typically, you know, European or Washington-based names, which have got other investors globally that know them very well. So once again, they can look at them and see value and provide the liquidity they're looking for in the portfolio. And similarly within credit, like the fact that we do have obviously a lot of short-dated credit means that it's coming through to maturity regularly. So we have that to lean on as well, for, you know, these stress times and to obviously provide that liquidity that you need. So that's, you know, once again, a key setup in terms of that barbell that I speak about is that it provides us with constant maturities that we can use to provide that liquidity. If we don't need it, we can invest back in to where we see value across the yield curve and in different sectors at all times. So that's, once again, a great way of getting true liquidity.
I think that rolling maturity is very important to build into a portfolio, and then you never have to, theoretically, if things are going well and you're a personal investor, you never actually have to sell you're not a forced seller into a market because you have that natural liquidity.
Yeah, I think forced selling is always costly. You know, banks are in the business providing liquidity, and at times like that, they want to really charge you for it. And so therefore, that bid-offer spread on bonds really widens. And, you know, not surprising, they're putting capital at risk at a time when it's risky. And so they want to take that opportunity. And so therefore, as you say, that gets quite challenging for you and costly if you don't, you know, provide liquidity in the fund in other ways.
What's the biggest mistake you see investors make when it comes to liquidity in fixed income markets?
Well, it probably is just what we ran through, really. It's just not having enough diversity. I think, once again, because you don't know, you know, what's going to cause that crisis, what's going to cause that risk, you know, you just, it's important, therefore, to have that exposure that is, you know, very diversified, not just, you know, clearly in terms of big sector, which I've sort of run through, you know, government, you know, semi-government, SSAs or corporate. You know, it's important to have it across even within those subsectors, and particularly when credit, because, you know, clearly some credits are going to be much more impacted during periods of, you know, some sort of crisis if they're central to it, whereas others are less likely to. You know, if you've got sort of those staples, I mean, you mentioned Telstra and sort of talking about it in a different way, but it's, you know, names like that are typically going to do reasonably well in, you know, a growth period or in a sort of a slowdown because they're a necessity, right? So, and fortunately in the Australian market and, you know, who's actually issued here, we do have a lot of companies that would fall into that. You know, they're, I guess, road tollways and airports and ports and all those things that, you know, are needed, whether the economy is sort of going up or going down. But clearly, you know, there's certainly a necessity in that asset. So by just having diversity across that, really is helpful. Also, I think we're lucky because we do have, I would say, what we call kangaroo bonds. So these are foreign issuers that are using our market. You know, often you'll find it's not all, I guess, regions that may be impacted at the same level. So, you know, US bank at this stage may feel better in some crises than owning European or Asian bank. So, you know, once again, having that sort of diversity across country is really, once again, quite helpful from a liquidity standpoint as well. But, you know, but not considering that, you know, you can get yourself caught.
That's excellent. And I'm sure our listeners are taking much away from our conversation today. Just one last question for me, really. What percentage of your portfolio would you hold in liquid assets? And does this change depending on market conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we obviously, once again, you know, the portfolio we're sort of talking about today, really, you know, the Australian bond fund, you know, it is, as I said before, very much meant to be available and to be liquid. We never want to be shutting the gate on it, like you've seen with some credit funds at different times. We do have to hold, you know, liquidity, and, you know, you can get it in different ways. As I said, I think it can be reasonably smart around by diversifying and understanding that diversity. But, you know, as a firm, our risk team does create reports to attempt to measure liquidity of the fund during normal times and also versus stress markets, because clearly we've seen a number of those over the years. So we have some understanding about, you know, how things change throughout that. And so therefore, you know, we're very conscious of that. And as I said, you know, by having sort of an increased weight to, I'd say, government exposure when we think the economy is weakening, obviously improves that ability to provide liquidity if, in fact, that does come through. So it's just, once again, you can't sort of talk enough about that need for some diversity to provide that liquidity through different crises. And that's certainly what we try and build in this fund. And therefore, not surprisingly, you know, it's a 85-90% of the fund we would call is very liquid, which once again speaks to the type of fund it is.
Just one last question as we're talking. I'm thinking about the ETFs and the passive investment ways to get access to the asset class, and that you offer a much more hands-on, you know, management approach. Do you want to just talk about that a little bit, Anthony?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and there's a number of factors here that you need to consider. I think, you know, a lot of these passive, obviously looking at, you know, at the benchmark, right? And I think bond benchmarks are often misunderstood when you compare them to equity benchmarks, because obviously with equity benchmarks, you know, a company that's successful becomes large part of the index. And that's generally what you'd want, right? You want successful companies to be a larger weight within your allocation. So passive sort of investment within equities has some sense. Whereas within bond indices, obviously the largest issuer is often the most indebted issuer, and therefore is making up a large percentage of that benchmark. And the question is, do you want to own that? Now, in the case of Australia, the market has changed a lot. The benchmark has become very heavy on the government side because, of course, federal government, state government's been doing a lot infrastructure-wise through the pandemic, et cetera. They've issued a lot. And so, therefore, their weight has increased immensely. Do you really need to hold that much of government assets in your bond portfolio? I would say you don't, because you can build something that's clearly defensive without having sort of 80, 90% of it in government. So by buying a passive index, that's what you're ending up with, generally speaking. If it's not, it's some concocted index, which sometimes doesn't have the diversity you're looking for. So whereas with what we do, we're trying to clearly build a fund that is broad in nature, provides that liquidity, which we've spoken a lot about today, providing you know, that diversity, which is key. And you can get that. You can build a fund, as I think, you know, we've run through today somewhat with that barbell discussion, which is not always the case. It's clearly a good case for now, but we have that ability to actively move it around. And I think, you know, look at, you know, the history of performance for active managers on the bond front. I think it's fair to say that, you know, active managers have consistently outperformed the benchmark. I know that's not the case within equities, but it is within bonds. And I know, you know, passive, you know, parties, you know, often talk about that, but they never talk about, you know, certainly the Australian bond market in their example, because, you know, history shows that generally active managers have outperformed passive over time. So that's the key difference. And, you know, what you really want to capture when you're investing in our market here.
Now, just wrapping up, are there any further comments that you'd like to make about the market or diversification, liquidity, the Australian bond fund?
Yeah, look, I think just, you know, once again, just highlighting, I guess, the Australian bond market. It's often misunderstood. It's not something that you can easily see, you know, because it's not as tradable as, say, the ASX, although I would say it is somewhat now. But, you know, it is generally sort of misunderstood in terms of how large it is and how it has grown, how different participants do use it from an investment point of view. As I mentioned before, you know, that broadness has really changed. But the issuers have also changed a lot. And, you know, it's pleasing to see, you know, Nestle is an example issuing here in Australia last week, is a good example of sort of that diversity of issuer that, you know, you can't, you know, get exposed to within equity space locally, but you can within the bond space. So you can get, you know, good diversity into your investment because of the fact that, you know, these foreign companies look at our market. They often have a business here. They want to fund it locally so they don't have to, you know, cross currencies, et cetera. And so it has grown quite a lot in terms of that diversity. And I think that's important to understand and important to recognize that you can get, you know, incredible diversity investing in an Aussie bond fund that can capture that sort of kangaroo bond issuance that we've have seen certainly over the last 10, 15 years.
Anthony Kirkham from Western Asset Management, it's been a joy to have you on the podcast today. We've learned so much. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Always enjoy catching up with you and having a chat. So thank you very much for the time today.
Thank you for joining us this week on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. Still hungry for more fixed income news, views and education? Then visit fixedincomenews.com.au and don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to have the latest news delivered right to your inbox. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Moran and we'll see you next episode on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast.